The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hello, everyone. I'm Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, and you are listening to the Book and Film Globe podcast. You can find our website at www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more. We have a great show for you this week, as always. Stephen Garrett will awaken from his garret in Berlin, and he's going to talk to me about Captain America, Brave New World, the latest edition in the endless Marvel Cinematic Universe that is now making lots of money worldwide. But first, I'm going to talk to contributor Michael Washburn about changes at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, which is sort of our major governmental arts institution in the United States. There have been some big changes there since Donald Trump retook the presidency earlier this year, and it's created quite a bit of controversy. And Michael and I are going to try to unravel the implications of the new Trump-run Kennedy Center right after this musical interlude. I don't know if you all are aware, but there has been a change of government in the United States. Donald Trump has retaken the White House. He was reelected. He has not retaken the White House. He is now the president again. And there's obviously a lot going on in American politics and in geopolitics. Things are changing very rapidly. But in our little corner of the world, our little cultural corner, there has been a development of a type that wasn't there during the first Trump presidency. Donald Trump has taken over the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, which is sort of our major fine arts institution in Washington, D.C., and this has led to much agitas in the world of culture, and we have covered it on Book and Film Globe. Our contributor, Michael Washburn, wrote a piece for us, and he's here today to talk to me about changes at the Kennedy Center. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Neil.
Hello. So why don't we summarize a little bit what has actually happened so far?
Well, in recent days, President Trump dismissed a number of the appointed trustees of the center, and there are a number who remain who are Trump appointees, and they have voted to make him the center's chair. And in addition, he appointed Richard Grinnell, who's an experienced diplomat who has done a lot of important work in Venezuela, as interim director. So there is new leadership in place, and there's presumably going to be a new direction at the Kennedy Center. And a lot of people are concerned. People are up in arms about what's been happening there. It is worth pointing out that the center is a division of the Smithsonian Institution and hence falls under the aegis of the federal government. So it's not as though Trump has moved into some private foundation and used the power of the state to remake its leadership as he sees fit. He has initiated some changes at the top, and that is arguably within his remit, just as he can make changes to other federal organizations.
It's essentially, as part of the executive branch, it's, you know, this is not a congressional institution, so it makes sense. He's the president. He's now the president of the Kennedy Center, just like he's the president of the United States. I think that's its official title. I'm sure it's an honorific. I don't think Donald Trump is going to be spending a lot of time programming what's going on at the Kennedy Center. Although I, you know, there's a couple of things that I have come up in recent days that I wanted to mention. One, I saw an interview with Richard Grinnell about the Kennedy Center, and he said he went in there and basically the cupboard was bare. Like, they had no money. The budget had been completely strapped, and he wasn't exactly sure. They haven't been doing a line for line. They haven't brought in Doge yet to do an audit of what the Kennedy Center was spending its money on. And there's also been a sort of a series of like high profile resignations from what I'm guessing are honorific positions. Well, the musician Ben Folds from the Ben Folds Five was apparently an advisor to the Kennedy Center's music programs, and he stepped away from that saying, quote, it's not for me. And then also there have been a lot of cancellations of performances. The comedian Issa Rae was scheduled to do a performance at the Kennedy Center. There have been some musical groups who were scheduled to perform at the Kennedy Center who are refusing to perform at the Kennedy Center now that Donald Trump is not just president, but in charge of the Kennedy Center. So, you know, I guess, like, Michael, none of this is really surprising, right? Like, the thing about the art and artists in America is they really hate Donald Trump.
Obviously, a lot of them do. But not all members of the artistic, entertainment, musical, dance, theater communities despise the man. And I think that it's easy to lose sight of that. And I think that those who held power at the Kennedy Center and were in charge of programming have long lost sight of that. And that's partly the reason for what's going on now. Because as I brought out in my piece, if you look back over programming over the last few years, what do you see over and over and over? It's really one viewpoint or a very narrow range of viewpoint that in no way is representative of the diversity of ideologies and beliefs among Americans. And as a branch of the federal government, you do have to wonder, well, why has the center been so monopolized by such a narrow range of viewpoints to the exclusion of all others? Is that right? Is that in keeping with its mandate? And should the new president and administration just allow business as usual there? Or should they say, hey, look, there are other voices out there in America, and there are people who would be delighted to perform or give concerts or shows and who have not had the opportunity to do so. So maybe now this is their moment, and maybe we can actually have diversity in practice as opposed to just this vapid catchphrase. And I think that is the motivation for a lot of the changes that we're seeing. And change is painful, and not everyone is going to react well, but I do see a rationale for what's going on here.
Yeah, I do as well. But I'm just kind of like wondering, what is a Donald Trump-run cultural institution going to look like? I mean, one of the things that, you know, always struck me about Trump's first term from 2016 to or 2017 to 2021 was how, not like there wasn't cult, there was pop culture. There was all kinds of culture in the United States, because, you know, there nothing stops the culture from moving forward. But, you know, there was no real government sponsorship of culture. Like, you know, in previous, you know, Republican administrations, there were state dinners featuring musicians and artists and writers. I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan, obviously Ronald Reagan was a cultural figure himself. He was an actor, but, you know, he was always hosting Stevie Wonder or Frank Sinatra or whatever, you know, always, you know, at the Kennedy Center waving at people wearing his tuxedo. And there was none of that during Donald Trump's first term. So I'm like wondering, like, what, I don't even know what Trump likes culturally. Like, what is it? I mean, you can't just have YMCA dance alongs, you know? It's like, there's no real indication as to what his tastes are. Maybe you have an idea.
Well, I think you may be missing the point somewhat, because I don't think that Trump's personal preferences are really the issue here. And I think that if he wants to introduce more diversity, then that's well and good. And a lot of the programming that has been on at the Kennedy Center can continue. And we should welcome that.
Yeah, classical music concerts, Christmas concerts, you know, the stuff that, you know, that offends no one and appeals to a broad range of people.
And left-leaning cultural productions, Leonard Bernstein and Leonard Cohen. And you may remember that Leonard Bernstein, one of the recent productions at the Kennedy Center was Mass. And there's this story about how this was produced all the way back during the administration of Richard Nixon. And members of the intelligence community told Nixon not to attend because there might be encoded Latin messages that would convey some kind of anti-Nixon or anti-Vietnam War message. And so this has been in the marrow of the Kennedy Center for a long time. And that should continue. That's well and good. But I think Trump's aim and Grenell's aim, of course, we have to see how things play out, but they want to introduce some real diversity, which is not to cancel or exclude anything that's been part of the programming, but simply to expand the programming, to include more voices, more viewpoints, to acknowledge the fact that there are conservatives in Hollywood and in the music community and the theater and dance performing arts, and we should welcome diversity in practice. So I don't see anything sinister about this, and I'm not sure where we fundamentally disagree here.
Oh, we don't. I mean, but I'm just trying to figure out like what is actually available. Like you mentioned, yes, the plays of David Mamet. Okay, yes, they could stage a David Mamet festival. He is famously gone over to the quote unquote dark side in recent years. They could, you know, I suppose you could do a Clint Eastwood film festival in the cinema. You know, there are some, I can't think of a lot of artists. I mean, yes, I can think of like political writers and comedians who maybe play, for the quote unquote other side. But in terms of like fine arts, I just feel like the ideological bias is so heavily anti-Trump that it's hard for me to imagine filling a cultural institution's entire docket. I don't know if I'm worried about it. This is just what I'm wondering.
Well, they've had no problem filling entire years of programming. And as I said just now, I don't think the idea is to overhaul and replace all the current program with new programming, but simply to introduce more diversity of viewpoint and perspective. There are all kinds of really spectacular productions that could happen under the auspices of the Kennedy Center if it had a real commitment to diversity. And one of the biggest performing arts productions this year is Shenyun 2025, China Before Communism. That's a huge show. That's a perfect illustration of I'm not going to say conservative because this comes from a cultural context, but a perspective, a point of view that is not often heard within the mainstream of American performing arts.
Yeah, but I mean, Shenyun is funded by the Falun Gong movement, you know, and it's not to say it should be performed in the United States, but is that really what you want to turn the Kennedy Center over to? I don't know. It strikes me that's opening up vast avenues for criticism, and I just feel like that's more trouble than it's worth. I guess what I'm saying is, sure, why not? You know, book Shenyun into the Kennedy Center, but that's not going to like cross the divide, the cultural divide that we're seeing right now. And I'm just wondering, like, where is the middle ground? I'm hoping that we can find something, and that, you know, they can maybe remake the Kennedy Center and, you know, give it a new paint job and, you know, freshen it up a little bit and make it more appealing to more people. But I'm just, I don't know. It's just a very strange phenomenon. And I'm upset that more artists aren't willing just to say, well, okay, Trump's the president now, but I'm still going to go perform at the Kennedy Center. That's really what they should be saying, in my opinion, regardless of who they voted for.
Well, the issue is that some of them really demand ideological purity,
yeah,
and they refuse to have anything to do with the venue if Trump is in charge, if he's calling the shots, and if he has a role in determining programming. But if the idea is simply to provide more balance, I don't know why they can't get behind that. And I don't know why they can't honor the commitments that they made and go on and perform and be part of this whole constellation of different viewpoints and ideas and perspectives. And I think that's what Trump wants. I think that's what Rick Grenell wants. And I think anyone who's been advocating for change at the Kennedy Center, again, is not against showing some of the things they've been showing, but simply asking why. Does Falun Gong not have a valid viewpoint? Is that viewpoint somehow marginal and niche in a way that drag queen productions are not? So why can't there be real diversity in practice? I think that's a perfectly fair, legitimate question to ask.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm down with Shenyun performing at the Kennedy Center, but I mean, I live in Texas, so the idea of I'm not going to see anything at the Kennedy Center anyway, but I would certainly be interested to see them put on, you know, performance, you know, some kind of David Mamet production, or, you know, or even just to foster the careers of artists of various from various genres who, you know, may not conform to the fashionable anti-Trump point of view that just like has completely dominated the arts for the last 10 years. So I don't know. It's something that we're going to continue to cover at Book and Film Globe, and I Michael Washburn, I thank you so much for stepping into the debate here.
Always a pleasure to speak with you, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
All right, bye-bye.
Wilson.
I want to make another run at making Captain America an official military position.
What if it's a trap?
Steven Garrett, like a Marvel character, travels around the world. You never really know where he's going to be from scene to scene. He could be in New York City in one scene and in rural West Virginia another scene, and or he can just be in Berlin doing skullduggery, which is what he's doing right now. Steven joins me from Berlin, where he's attending the Berlinale, the Berlin Film Festival. Hello, Steven.
Hello. Good night. Hello.
Which edition of the... which good enough to you?
This is the, as one guy said, willkommen to the 75 Berlinale.
It's a big one.
It's a big one. Diamond Jubilee.
The Diamond Jubilee of the Berlinale. But we're not talking about the Berlinale yet. We're probably going to do a segment about that in the coming weeks. But instead, we're going to talk about a very non-film festival movie. We're talking about Captain America Brave New World, which kicks off the Marvel 2025 calendar. Here's the thing about Brave New World. Well, first of all, it was supposed to be called New World Order.
That's true.
And they changed it to Brave New World. I don't know why they were afraid of calling it New World Order. It's not like that's a phrase that, you know, that anyone finds offensive. Oh no, you can't call it. You might make Donald Rumsfeld's ghost mad.
Maybe they just felt it wasn't it was a little unemotional. Brave New World, he says the word brave in it. And new, like this is a new movie and there's a new brave hero, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's also the title of a classic Aldous Huxley
that's
novel.
True.
That's far more prophetic and compelling and braver than this movie, which mind you, is a perfectly, you know, this movie's been pretty well ridiculed by critics, although fans seem to like it okay. It's been much derided. It's, I would say, a bit unfairly derided. It is, to me, a perfectly reasonable entry in the, you know, chapter in the endless ongoing Marvel saga that will consume the rest of our lives.
Exactly. I mean, it's the latest issue, right, of the ongoing comic book.
Yeah.
And I thought it was fine. I thought it was absolutely fine. Like, it did everything I was expecting it to do. It's in that it did everything that these movies always do. So how can I penalize it for meeting that challenge?
It hardly overreaches its ambition.
It may not do that. But, yeah, I'm not too the whole Red Hulk thing you'll have to school me on, because I guess that's a thing, right?
So here's the deal. All right, you mentioned the Red Hulk. I mean, that's no surprise. That's in the trailer and in every ad for the movie.
And on the poster and everywhere.
And on the poster. So it's not like oh, the president turns into the Red Hulk. That's the big reveal. The thing about this movie is it's advertised as a Captain America movie. And it does. The main character is Anthony Mackie's Sam Wilson, who is the new Captain America. Since 2021's... The Falcon and the Winter Soldier TV show that was on Disney Plus that you may or may not have seen, but it, you know, he becomes Captain America. He just dons the mantle that was abandoned by Steve Rogers. But this is not really a Captain America movie. This is kind of a stealth sequel to Marvel's Hulk movie from 2008.
Right.
You know, which was really the first Marvel Cinematic Universe movie. It predates Jon Favreau's Iron Man. It was so long ago that Ed Norton played the lead, and William Hurt, who played the main villain or one of the main villains, you know, the actor is dead.
Right.
And his character,
because he's older than Harrison Ford. Let's be honest.
Like, no, just because he died because he's a person who died.
He was an
older
man.
No one's older than Harrison Ford.
Right. Okay.
I mean, boy, does he look haggard in this thing? My God, he's gravelly and haggard.
It's his second topless big screen role in the past like 3 years, though.
Yeah,
because he was topless in that Indiana Jones movie.
That shirt comes off at the very end. He plays General Ross, President Ross, Thunderbolt Ross, who is essentially the Incredible Hulk's father-in-law. I mean, his daughter, Betty Ross, is Bruce Banner's girlfriend. She's played by Liv Tyler, who does sneak in to the movie in an incredibly like unemotional and unmoving end scene where it's like, oh, here's this character that hasn't been seen in the Marvel Cinematic Universe in 7 years, and we're gonna, you know, bring her back in the limpest.
7 years, 17 years.
17. Did I say 7? Yeah, 17 years. Yeah. So yeah. So, but that, but the really the story, you know, yes, they do continue some threads of Sam Wilson's story from The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, but the real story is a continuation of 2008's Incredible Hulk movie, to the extent that the villain, the main villain, the leader, Samuel Stearns, played by Tim Blake Nelson, was in that movie and hasn't been seen since. And now he looks like a cauliflower.
But they didn't call him the leader in this movie, did they?
No, but he is the leader. He's the leader. The leader in the Marvel movies is the green guy who gets a little dose of gamma radiation, and he has a big brain, and he's completely crazy.
But he has a pencil-thin mustache and a like a pill-shaped head, though, too, right? He's not a cauliflower.
It's a larger head, yeah. Right, right. It's not an exact replica of that character. It is a sort of a... He is a smaller head, although that brain, what a brain. It's everywhere.
What a brain. I love that comic book villains with who are incredibly smart have enormous craniums, as though that's some indication that he's like, oh no, really smart, because his head is huge.
Right, not that he has hydroencephalitis or something. He's manipulating stuff behind the scenes, and one of the things he's manipulating is that the president is actually an evil Hulk, a Red Hulk. I don't remember exactly. The Red Hulks kind of came along after I was reading. There weren't Red Hulks when I was a kid. There's really one Hulk, and then there is a female Hulk, and then they were green. And there's just been an expansion of Hulkness, and red is just one of the colors that they can be now. They can also be gray, apparently. So the Red Hulk makes an appearance toward the end and really tears shit up. Destroys the White House.
He does a number on the White House. He maims it quite considerably.
Something that perhaps a metaphor, but really this is like a very apolitical movie. I mean, the main antagonist, national antagonist for the United States in this movie is Japan.
Right. Yeah.
Ooh, the scary. Yeah. Here come the Japanese again. In their nice suits and with their two fighter planes. How are we ever going to beat Japan?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because there really isn't, there's no existential threat to the universe,
no.
Let alone the planet in this. It's kind of nice. It's a little more regional.
Yeah, well, that's the Captain America movies tend to be, you know, they call them like 70s style political thrillers. You know, we all remember the scene in the Parallax View where the Red Hulk destroys the Pentagon. three days of the Condor or whatever, where the flying Falcon man flies around and with his shield wings, so there's like some Captain America tomfoolery going on. There's a new Falcon. What's his name? Joaquin Ramirez.
Yeah. Joaquin Torres.
Joaquin Torres.
He's a friendly enough little puppy of a soldier
he's a cutie.
Eager to get in the mix.
He's an eager little cutie.
Yeah. Danny Ramirez from Top Gun Maverick.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's got some spark. You know, Bucky Barnes pops in. Oscar nominee Sebastian Stan pops in
right.
for a little few quips. You know, the Marvel movies, there's always like some kind of like, there's always some new character that's kind of cute. And there's a couple good set pieces here. I liked the fighter pilot, the airplane set piece taking place in the Indian Ocean. I thought that was pretty fun.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't a masterpiece.
Yeah, no, it wasn't a masterpiece. But I was kind of curious about Ruth Bat Seraph, who pops up, played by Shira Haas. Is she some significant? She's ex-Black Widow.
Yeah.
Right. She was trained in the Red Room or brainwashed.
But. Yeah. Ruth Bat Seraph is an interesting character because she's Marvel's Israeli superhero, known in the comic books as Sabra.
Oh.
And they kind of toned that down a little bit because, you know, you don't want to make the Israelis look good.
God forbid.
God forbid there should be an Israeli hero that might hurt the global box office. She's about 4'6", 95 pounds of just pure uncoiled, you know, kung fu energy. Shira Haas, she's a TV actor. She was in Schitzel, and she's well known for like shows about life in Israel. So, you know, she's now been sucked into the Marvel Borg, and she's their Israeli hero. So she was fine. She was, you know, perfectly. I'm like, it's nice to. They didn't really do much with her Judaism.
Well, that's the thing. I feel like the whole character and everything. It was one of those times where, one of many, where I'm watching a Marvel movie and there's a peripheral character that sometimes makes the audience kind of go, ooh, or ah, or clap softly because it's somebody with some significance. But she doesn't seem to do more than kind of grimace and play. She just seems like a Secret Service.
Well, why does the president have an Israeli chief of security, the president of the United States? It makes no sense. But there's lots of like, there's lots of that in this movie where suddenly the characters are all in this place together.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Fighting in a hallway. It really is like, you know, it's like you said, Stephen, it's like the issue of the Marvel comic book came in the mail and we all read it. And then
that was a fun adventure.
It was a fine adventure. I think this is going to end up, you know, people love doing those lists of, you know, the Marvel movies ranked.
Right. Right.
Right. This is not going to be at the top.
This won't be on the top, but I have to say, like,
maybe toward the bottom, yeah, toward the bottom.
I think there are movies that have token sort of diversity and others that go a little bit further into exploring a narrative arc that is, I think, becoming more mainstream and maybe to the point where it's, I wouldn't want to say it's cliche, but I sat up a little when that character Isaiah Bradley, who I guess was introduced on the miniseries or the limited series, but to have this Korean War vet who's basically as old as Captain America, and as a super soldier, but basically was imprisoned and experimented on for 30 years. I thought that was like...
it was like a Tuskegee experiment.
Exactly. But to see that be so kind of... I mean, when it's brought up in the movie, he's kind of like, oh yeah, this happened to him. And he's explaining it to Danny Ramirez's character, Joaquin, as a sort of like, this happened, right? And Danny Ramirez is like, yeah, oh, that sucks. You know what I mean? Almost like not to make light of it, but he's more like, yeah, that kind of happens to us more than it doesn't. You know, that there's this sort of resignation of like, yeah, this is what it's like to be Black in America, which I thought was new and different in terms of, I'm just saying, not necessarily Marvel, but just to see in a mainstream movie like that. And to see that relationship be the that's the one arc in the movie. That's the relationship he has. It's not with a wife or a loved one or a child, it's with this father figure, this avuncular character who is almost like the imprisoned uncle who doesn't want to serve again and everything. I just thought I found that compelling and fresh and interesting to see in a Marvel movie.
It's an interesting storyline, but I feel like the problem with the movie is that it really, the real movie though, was not about that. Like they did that, most of that storyline in The Falcon and the Winter Soldier in 2021, This movie is really, at the end of the day, it's really Harrison Ford's story. You know, he is the character who has the most dramatic stuff going on and who has the strongest storyline and who really like just steals every scene he's in. You know, Anthony Mackie is very laconic. And I just felt like this is just Harrison Ford just like going balls to the wall in every scene he's in.
So you're saying that
it's
that
a Hulk movie.
America story in the Captain America movie is the B story.
Yes.
In this, that is overwhelmed by the A story of Red Hulk, who
absolutely
surprisingly, not surprisingly, shows up at the end.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. This is essentially not a Captain America movie. It is marketed as such, but really it's a Hulk movie without the Green Hulk in it because they don't have the Green Hulk right now. And I feel like there's a reason why they had so many problems with this movie is because they couldn't decide. There's two movies battling. There's like a Hulk movie battling to get out of the Captain America movie.
Oh, metaphor.
Well, not even a metaphor. It's like what's actually happening. And then when the Hulk finally does appear, I'm like, oh, this is what the movie's about. Okay. And then the Hulk's jumping around, you know, the National Mall. And you're like, well, this is, you know, this is what a 10-year-old wants to see.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Not like mopey Sam Wilson moping about being a mope, you know?
Well, it also drives home the point that Sam Wilson is not a super soldier. He hasn't taken the serum, nor does he want to.
Yeah.
And he is kind of immortal the way that Iron Man was a mortal person who had a lot of great tech that supercharged him.
Sure. All right. That's all.
Yeah, trying true. To be kind.
Yes, Steven, can we watch the movie. Congratulations.
Can we talk about the end credit scene? Because it is the most generic end credit scene warning of some generic villain that will come up in some generic movie. It's like they just don't even care anymore. They're like, yeah, oh, you better be ready. They're coming.
Yeah, here's the thread. Okay, pull it. Just pull it. Give it a little tug. You know, and it's like, and the irony being that warning comes from a character who has not appeared in a Marvel movie in 17 years. It so long ago that like half the people who are going to see this movie weren't even born when that character was introduced.
But they're coming. This is what I find interesting. I feel like when those post-credit scenes popped up, they were in service of a very clear narrative that they were establishing and always Avengers related, right? Because there's Nick Fury or some other guy popping up. And well, then
here they come.
Well, no, and then the past couple movies have had, or the past couple years worth of movies have had, you know, like at the end of Eternals, they introduced new weird characters that never got reintroduced or brought into a part of the storyline, or it was like Kang and that blew up in their faces. So now they're just like, they're coming. There's some generic guy we just don't want to even commit to yet.
You got to wait 20 years.
We don't want it to bite us in the ass.
Yes. Well, this movie is not going to bite you in the ass. You can sit your ass down and watch it for a couple hours and then go on with your day. Stephen Garrett, enjoy your currywurst. I think it's
midnight. I had one yesterday.
Oh, I'm so sure good. You did. I hate that stuff. God, it's so gross. But let's you know, basically top a hot dog with bad ketchup that has onions in it.
Delicious.
All right, thank you so much. Talk to you later.
Yeah.
Stephen Garrett, is there a movie coming out next week?
I thought you'd never ask, but I'm here to warn you that yes, there is a movie that everyone needs to see.
And it's coming.
It's coming soon.
Well, we'll be back. All right. Thank you so much, Stephen Garrett. Captain America, Brave New World is in pretty much every theater everywhere in the world right now. Not so brave, really. Not so new. But it is in the world, and you could see it if you want. I mean, everyone likes to see Hulks throwing helicopters into buildings. I am Neil Pollack, the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, otherwise known as the Blue Hulk, and I host the show every week, and I aim to entertain and inform and enlighten you all. Thank you so much again to Stephen Garrett and to Michael Washburn for discussing changes at the Kennedy Center, now under the auspices of President Donald Trump, both President of the United States and President of the Kennedy Center. I think that's the first time that's ever happened. You can catch my new show at the Kennedy Center, a musical tribute to the Proud Boys, and that will begin rehearsals sometime this summer, and hopefully we can launch it in the fall if we can find any actors and musicians who are willing to participate. Again, I'm Neil Pollack. I'm the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe. Thank you so much for listening to the show, and I will talk at you next week.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at the Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's the Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.